make it that there will not be a single formula or mathematical equation this entire talk. And instead, there will be a lot of colors and a lot of pictures. I don't know if I should make an apology for that. Just expect something different. What I thought I would do today, I'm a neurobiologist, so what I'm interested in is how the nervous system and the brain and spinal cord, particularly in mammals like us, works. And I'm going to talk about stem cells today, but from the perspective of someone who's interested in the nervous system, both from a basic biological perspective, but also from the perspective of trying to treat a lot of really devastating conditions that we really have no treatment for at the time, things ranging from Parkinson's disease to spinal cord injury. But I'm not going to launch right away into my own research, because I realize that most of you have never, you've seen mice, but it's only been in your house, for example. And you probably don't know much about stem cells. So I'm going to give sort of an introduction to stem cells first. And then after I've kind of given you a perspective to think about the things I do within, then I will try and use my own work as a way of illustrating for you the questions many people are trying to ask with regard to stem cells, both from the basic biology perspective and from a therapeutic perspective right now. And at the end, if there's time, I'll try and come back to some of the bigger, broader questions again after that. Now, this picture here simply illustrates for you what neural stem cells can do, and I'm going to talk about that in a bit more detail after I give you my introduction. This is a poster that was put together by one of the networks of Centers of Excellence here in Canada. There's a stem cell network. And as some of you may know, one of the mandates of the NCEs in Canada is to educate. And so they put together this as part of an educational package for schools. And what I would like to use it for you is to just define some terms. When you think stem cells, or when most of the public thinks stem cells, newspapers talk about them, frequently what they're talking about are the stem cells that are shown over here, which are embryonic stem cells. I will call them ES cells, just for short. Now, embryonic stem cells are really remarkable cells. They derive from the very early fertilized blastocyst. And because at that stage, basically every cell in that very early embryo could make every tissue in your body, the embryonic stem cells that people isolate from that particular stage can also make, at least in theory, every cell type in your body. So these are really magical cells in the sense that they can make your heart, your liver, your brain, etc. Now, whether we could ever in a dish put those things together appropriately or give them the right cues is a different issue. But they really are what's called pluripotent, or they can make many, many things. Now, these are the cells that people have all of the ethical issues with for all the obvious reasons, because they derive from blastocysts, early human blastocysts. There's a second type of cell, which is also a stem cell, but a very different kind of cell. Now, those are the adult stem cells. And I just want to, again, a semantic issue, is that when we say adult stem cells, they can come from developing fetuses. The thing about an adult stem cell is that it can't make every cell type in your body, and instead comes from a specific tissue. So, for example, if I was to tell you about a neural stem cell or a nervous system stem cell, that could either come from an adult brain, or it could come from a brain of a late gestation fetus. I would still call it an adult stem cell. Now, one of the major differences between these embryonic stem cells and adult stem cells is that these cells are not pluripotent. They can make a number of different cell types, but they can't make everything. And there's been a lot of debate in, newspaper, religious societies, etc., people think about ethics, about whether we should even study these stem cells over here, ES cells, when we have adult stem cells. The argument, though, is that we do not have adult stem cells that can make every cell type in your body. So most scientists will fall out on the side saying, we should study both these populations at the same time, because if we could make every cell type in your body from a variety of different adult stem cells, if we could really harness them, then we could use them for everything. But that's not reality at this point.
Can I ask, is it?
Sure.
What is understood about how these pluripotent things differentiate?
Oh, that's a million-dollar question. It really is. I'm not joking.
Nobody knows.
We're only starting to have insights. Because if you think about it, what you're really asking is, how does an embryo make itself? In a sense, right? Because that's exactly the same thing that those cells have to do when they build an embryo. They have to generate cardiac cells and liver cells, etc. And it's a complex biological question. The state of the art, with some exceptions, is that we know we can make, for example, cell type X. Let's say it's a particular type of brain cell.
So when we differentiate these things in a dish, we make the cell type of interest together probably with a bunch of other cells, because we don't control it very well yet. So what most people are doing, and I'll give you an example of that, is they're somehow recognizing the cell they want, and then they're isolating that from this whole group of differentiated cell types. So the answer to your question is that we don't yet know very much. And one of the reasons people actually are excited about studying these cells from a completely basic perspective is that they hope we can gain insights into development that we couldn't get in any other way.
But even for rats or rabbits or other creatures, we don't know much.
No, we don't know much at all. And as a matter of fact, it's only been within the past 4 years, 5 years, I guess, that we can even get, maybe a bit longer, 6 years, we can even get these particular cells from a human. A lot of the work that you see discussed is actually done with human cells. So I just wanted to come back to this again. I've sort of said a lot of these things just to set the baseline in a way, that to remind you that yes, cells can differentiate into all the cells of the body. While these adult stem cells are largely tissue biased, so if I get a stem cell from your brain, it largely makes brain cell types, for example. And many of these adult stem cells don't proliferate or divide very well and expand. But then we come to this other issue, is what are the advantages of adult stem cells? Well, if you get them from adult tissues, then you have none or very few ethical issues associated with their use. And this is another big advantage from a medical perspective, is that even if we as a society agreed that embryonic stem cells, that we had no ethical issues associated with the fact that they derive from early human embryos, nonetheless, if we're going to use them therapeutically, for example, for cell transplantation, we're faced with the fact that those cells came from another human being. So just like with tissue transplantation and organ transplantation, that's called a heterologous transplant. And for me to accept a tissue like a liver or a heart from someone else, I have to be immunosuppressed so I don't reject that organ. It's going to be the same problem if we use things like embryonic stem cells because they come from another human. The advantage of adult stem cells is theoretically, at least, I could take a stem cell from your own tissue, grow it up, make it divide into the cell type I was interested in, and then treat you with your own cells. And therefore, that would be called autologous transplantation, and we wouldn't have to worry about those cells being injected.
Question?
Sure.
Are these guys stem cells just by virtue of some quirk of genetics, or is it because they haven't divided as many times? So in a sense, are they younger?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Are stem cells just younger cells, or are they immortal cells? I think that's kind of the question.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
can they go on forever and divide forever and always make it?
Like when they cloned Dolly was born old because the cells already had shortened.
Yes, exactly. I think that has not been answered. If they're truly, truly immortal outside of the animal, for most adult stem cells, it has been in embryonic stem cells, they hate as if they're immortal, most of them. They'll just go on forever, as far as we can tell. One of the definitions of a stem cell, though, to get into sort of the more fine points of it, is that it is immortal within the context of the body. So in other words, if I take it out of the body and make it divide way more times than it ever would in an organism, it might not be immortal. But perhaps if it only divides once a week like it would in my body, it will be immortal within the perspective of my mortality. Okay? So that's part of the definition of the stem cell. So to come back to part of the issue of what are they anyway, remember that when you build an embryo, and this is a picture of a mouse embryo, that you have to have stem cells to build all the tissues anyway. And this is just an example of the things I call neural stem cells, which are the stem cells that build your spinal cord in your brain. And this is just a little mouse embryo that's been manipulated so that it expresses in a subset of all of its newly born nervous system cells a protein called beta-galactosidase, which I can stain with a dye so that all those cells turn blue. And you can see that this entire brain, this is the brain and the spinal cord here, is being built of these stem cells. Now, about 10 years ago, or a little bit more than that, a colleague of mine, actually we were graduate students at the same time, Calgary, Sam Weiss, made a big surprise discovery. And up until about that time, most of us have been taught, if we ever took a biology class, that basically, you know, when you're young, you build your brain and your circuitry, And then you keep all of those nerve cells till you're about 21 or 22, and then depending on how much you drink at university and how badly you behave, you start killing them, and then that's it. There's no, it's a one-way street. You have a finite number of these cells, never more to be generated. And what Sam discovered is that that wasn't true. Is that the mammalian...
Let's drink to Sam.
So, at any rate, what Sam discovered, completely by serendipity actually, his graduate student, Brent Reynolds, I should say did that, was to discover that if you put neural tissue from the adult brain into a certain cocktail of growth factors, that what he generated were these funny little floating spheres of cells, and that these floating spheres of cells, being a good graduate student, you didn't just throw them away as some kind of weird artifact, you have to ask what they were, and what they were is stem cells for the brain. And what they found is that even in the adult brain, first they worked on rodents, and now it's been shown for humans, that there are stem cells that can make new nerve cells. Moreover, since that time, not only have they discovered that there are stem cells that can do that, but that they do that, and that they're physiologically important. And in particular, this is a picture of some of the cells that have come from these stem cells. There's all the little green cells here that are migrating along this blue thing within the brain of a rodent. And it's showing you some new nerve cells that have been made and that are on their way to a place called the olfactory bulb, which is involved in smell. And what people have found is that as an adult, you make new neurons for things like learning and memory, potentially, and for things like certain very instinctive behaviors, like olfaction and maternal behavior. So this is a real revolution. People are particularly interested in this idea of learning and memory. I mean, there's a million studies, you know, taking rats and having them do exercise or taking them and, you know, exposing them to enriched environments where they see a lot of interesting new things, and asking whether that enhances the number of new nerve cells you make. And the answer is actually yes, you do. But what people are even more excited about is the fact that in some circumstances, it looks like these stem cells are recruited to make new nerve cells following injury, like following an ischemic stroke or something. Obviously, they don't do it very well because most people don't recover from those kinds of injuries. But nonetheless, the possibility is suggested that if you could figure them out, maybe you could allow us to repair ourselves. So this brings me to this slide, which is, so then what is all the fuss about anyway with regards to being excited about stem cells and therapy? Well, most of what you see and much of what is talked about has to do with cell replacement. So for example, if I have a disease like Parkinson's disease where you lose a certain subpopulation of nerve cells in your brain, the idea is we could use stem cells to make those nerve cells, put them back in, and treat the disease. But I think an idea that many of us are much more excited about, but that's much more far future, is that you could actually take the stem cells that reside in your brain, and this is a picture of some of them here, these little golden or white dots here, that you could actually convince them to repair the brain itself, for example, or the heart itself, depending on the tissue you're interested in. We don't know how to do that very well yet. And it comes down to questions like, how do we convince them to divide? How do we convince them to differentiate? How do we keep that going for the right period of time? But the hope is, if we have enough understanding of the basic signaling mechanisms inside of those cells, that we could even develop, for example, small molecules that we could treat people with to recruit and coax these cells to repair people who have injuries or diseases. And with regards to the nervous system in particular, the kinds of diseases people think about are things like Parkinson's disease. As I told you, that's a disease that it's usually elderly people, and a famous person who isn't so elderly who has it is Michael J. Fox. This is a disease, a movement disorder, and it comes from your brain, and you lose a particular class of nerve cells, and the idea is that maybe we could just replace them. A second type of disease is something called the demyelinating disease. I'm going to come back to this. In your brain, much as in an electrical circuit, you have connections. But those connections, they only fire action potentials and conduct the electrical impulse as well if they're basically insulated. The insulation in your brain is something called myelin. And it's just these lipid layers that are wrapped around and around the actual connections themselves. When that insulation goes wrong, one of the diseases that's most familiar to people is multiple sclerosis. All of a sudden, the connections don't fire at the right pace anymore, and you really have problems. People with MS end up in wheelchairs and die from the disease. So one of the hopes is that we can put in these insulin ablation-forming or myelin-forming cells back into multiple sclerosis, for example, and that we can help to fix that disease. And the one I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about is spinal cord injury. So just to come back to then, what are the issues with these ideas that we could use cells to treat these different things? Well, I already told you that one of the big issues is a societal one. The discussion of whether or not it is appropriate to use embryonic stem cells, which derive from these very early human embryos, or not. And different countries have come to different resolutions for that. Certain countries in Europe, it is absolutely forbidden to even do research on ES cells. In Canada, we sort of sit on the fence as we do many things. We've said it's okay to use ES cells, human ES cells. It's even okay to make new human ES cell lines from discarded embryos from in vitro fertilization clinics, for example, that have all these embryos in the freezer that they just throw out after a certain period of time. In the States, ironically, is very liberal. Even though there's all this fuss and we hear about it all the time, ironically, heard for several reasons, but I mean, for the, and we all hear about how restrictive it is and how there's all this fighting going on. And yet, if you are in a company in the US, you can do any kind of research you want in human embryonic stem cells. You can even try to clone a human being out of them. No, honestly, it's not against the law. Canada, that kind of research is, that's illegal. You would go to jail for that. What is restricted is if you get federal funding in the US. You cannot do those experiments. So it's a bit of a, it's a rather strange legislative situation. So that's one of the issues. The second issue is, as I mentioned, this issue of transplanting in cells that don't belong to you. And that, maybe if you're a Parkinson's patient, you're 70 years old, it doesn't matter to you if you're immune suppressed for the rest of your life, but if you're an 18-year-old spinal cord injury victim, bad enough to have a spinal cord injury without sort of adding insult to injury and giving you these really awful immune suppressing drugs and steroids and things that people use. And finally, the pressing question that was asked over here is we know very little of how to actually make these stem cells do what we want them to. So my laboratory, not quite 10 years ago, this clip is saying perhaps more like 7 or so. Go ahead.
I just had a question about treating diseases like Parkinson's. Some of these diseases are autoimmune, is that true?
Diabetes, juvenile diabetes certainly is, yes.
Okay, and I was just wondering, so if you replace the cells, will they simply be killed again?
That's another excellent question. And one of the situations where people make the argument, let's go back to that issue here. I just told you there's a problem transplanting in the heterologous cells. If you have something like juvenile diabetes, where the reason those kids lose those cells, the insulin-producing cells, is because they've mounted an immune response against them, and the cells are basically die. Then in that case, you're going to have to immune suppress them anyway, no matter whose cells you put back in. So actually, the argument is we should still treat them. And yes, over time, they may well kill those cells as well, necessitating a second or third transplant. But you're going to have to immune suppress them anyway. And actually, Canada has been a leader in this in Edmonton. There's something called the Edmonton Protocol. And not from stem cells, but they actually take cadavers and people who have donated their bodies. They harvest insulin-producing cells from them and transplant them in these kinds of diabetics and immune suppress them. And actually, in some of those patients, there's been a phenomenal success. The problem is, just like you said, though, that it only lasts for, you know, however many years, and then you would have to do it again. In that case, we just don't have anywhere near the number of donors that we would need. So that's the argument for trying to use stem cells. So my laboratory chose to do was come back to this issue of source. And what we thought was, you know, we do a lot of basic science on how the nervous system develops. But we thought if we could do something therapeutically interesting, perhaps what we could do is simply try to find a source of stem cells for the nervous system that wouldn't come from this ethically problematic cell type ES cells, but would instead come from an adult stem cell, but someplace outside the nervous system, because obviously it's very difficult to go into people's brains to try and get their stem cells out to then treat them. And the place that we turn to is the skin. Now, if you're looking for an accessible source of stem cells, I think, well, that's an obvious one. It's right out here. It grows. You know, there's lots of it, etc. Scientifically, though, you'd say, why would you ever imagine that you could get a cell type to treat your nervous system with out of your skin? Well, there's actually hints in the literature. Much of it comes from amphibian research, a bit from mammals. And what that research says is the following. if you look at the skin, and this is just a picture of skin that's been stained in a certain way, up here on the top, the layer that faces the world is your epidermis, and this is the protective barrier. But underneath that, as anybody who's cut themselves knows, is the dermis. And the dermis is a whole gamut of different cell types. Within that, you know, real blend of cell types are cells that allow you to feel things like pressure. So if I press down here, I can actually sense that. Those cells that do that in your dermis are a type of neural cell, a type of nervous system cell. And there's actually literature, largely in amphibians, that if you get rid of those cells somehow in an adult amphibian, in the dermis, somehow they regenerate, they come back. So what does that tell you? It tells you that there's some kind of a precursor or stem cell or parent cell in the dermis that can give rise to at least one kind of neural cell. And there's some evidence that that happens, actually, from McMaster, actually, from Colin Nurse and Jack Diamond when he was still there, that they may exist, that may happen in mammals as well. So on the basis of that kind of rationale, we asked whether we could find a stem cell that looked like a nervous system cell type in the skin. And we basically just used the same methods that have been used to get them from the brain. We took the skin, we started with rats and mice, and we chopped it up into little single cells, and then we put them in the same cocktail of growth factors and asked if we could get these floating spheres of cells. And the answer was that yes, we could, that we could grow and expand these floating spheres of cells for a long time, and that they had many characteristics of the stem cells from your brain. I'm just going to orient you to this kind of picture a little bit because it will be a bit foreign to you. What we do in this picture is we've taken one of these spheres and we've put it down on a sticky surface. The cells spread out and then we stain them with a dye, a nuclear dye. It's called phosphere, which is blue under the microscope. So we can see the nucleus of every cell in the dish. And then we can take and use techniques to specifically light up certain proteins. And that's what's red. So this particular protein we're looking at here is something that's expressed specifically on stem cells from your brain. So those are the kind of techniques we use to say these look like the right thing. But the question is, do they make the right thing? Do they make nervous system cell types? And sure enough, even right from our very early experiments, it looked like they did. What you're looking at here now is a picture very similar to the one I showed you, except now we used for staining these cells a protein that is specific to nerve cells. And you can see these beautiful, this is the cell body, and it has all these long processes that would be connections if it was in an animal. These beautiful nerve cells, which are neurons. So it looked like they might be able to make nervous system cell types. We got a big surprise, though, when we looked at other cell types that were in a certain condition of cells differentiating in a dish. And we saw things that looked like fat cells. And here, this is a single cell, and it's been stained with a dye that binds to lipids. So these are all little lipid droplets that are inside of fat cells. The reason this was a surprise is because during development, fat cells and nervous system cells come from different places. So what this was arguing was that this cell was more multipotent than we would have predicted. And of course, we did the important experiment of showing that we could take a single cell, grow it up into all of its daughters, and that all those daughters would make these different cell types. Because we had started from a therapeutic perspective right at the beginning of this project, we immediately turned to human cells. And the type of human cells that we had, human skin that we had ready access to, was human foreskin, which by definition almost comes from little, a certain sized infant baby boys. And we were able to use these, use basically the same techniques. And sure enough, we could get these floating spheres of cells, which potentially could be expanded and grown for over a year, without changing their genetics, apparently, and that they too look like nervous system cell types, and they could make things that look like nervous system cells, like neurons, as well as, in this case, what I'm showing you over here is a kind of an assay we can do to argue that perhaps they're even making bony cells in this situation. So I'm not going to go into any more detail of all of that work. It's a huge amount of work. It's been published in a number of papers. But I wanted to conclude that work by saying that what we had in our hands then, apparently, was a cell that came from the skin, and it did come from the dermis, that could be grown in a culture dish, and that could give a whole variety of different cell types, including cell types that belong to the nervous system, and cell types of a completely different type of origin, including bone cells, cartilage cells, fat cells, and smooth muscle. I should tell you that all of these are called mesodermal cell types, and they all have a parent stem cell that sits above them.
So are, were these found by a hit and miss procedure, or did you know what to put in the cocktail?
Yeah, that's a good question too. This was hit and miss, these first ones. It was just, we put them under, we stuck them down. We gave them serum because there's a lot of stuff in serum. These are really, you know, what I call kitchen sink experiments, right? You just kind of throw things on and look to see what happens. And this, the adipocytes too. Once we started to suspect they make this class of cells, from the developmental literature, there are certain factors and environments that are known to push cells to make these cell types. So we use those, and that's how we found them. So it was a mixture of just looking and a little more informed looking.
So they might be able to make even more kinds.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm going to tell you, I think that they do. And I'll tell you why I think that now. So what I'd like to do then is just give you, at this point, we felt if we were ever going to use these cells therapeutically that we had better answer some very basic biology about them, because you can be really tricked with this kind of cell biology, tricked as a scientist. I can look at those things, and you know, it's the funny thing about the dog, you know, looks like a dog, walks like a dog, but is it really a dog? You know, I mean, how do you prove that something in a culture dish that looks right, has the right proteins, but is it really a functional, bona fide cell type? So we thought one way of asking that was to ask something about why we even have a cell like this in skin. Well, we thought long and hard, and we realized that those of us who had remembered our developmental biology, that actually there is a cell in the embryo that has a very similar type of differentiation potential. And that cell is something called the neural crest cell. And I just want to tell you a little bit about it. Basically, during the embryo, as you're making your spinal cord in your brain, what you do is you make this long tube. It's called the neural tube. And there's a population of cells that kind of peel off the top of that tube and migrate out and go all through your body and make a huge number of different cells, including neural cells and these mesodermal cells. And in particular, they make your whole peripheral nervous system, that is all the nerves out here, and sensory receptors and things. They make cells in your different glands, like the adrenal gland. Importantly, in your head, they make all the dermis in your face. They make bone and cartilage in your head, fat cells, etc. So here was a cell that kind of looked, in terms of potential, like the cell we had isolated, but from an adult tissue, not from an embryo. And then we did a whole series of studies, just kind of correlative studies, saying, well, these neural crest cells in the embryo express this, they look like this, do our cells look like that? And the answer was that they had similarities. And I'm not going to go through this list for you, suffice it to say that many of the genes that are expressed in these embryonic neural crest cells were also expressed in our cells that we isolated from skin, which we called SCIPs, for skin-derived precursors. So we did one experiment, which I think was the most definitive one, which is why I'm showing you. We said, well, if these things really are basically the adult version of this cell that's previously only been seen in an embryo, then can we take it and put it back into an embryo and have it behave like the embryonic cell developmentally? And the way that we did that is in collaboration with Nick Rainfuse at Dalhousie and his project student Adrian, is we went into chicks, little developing chicks in the egg. And this is what you're looking at here is you can cut a window on the egg and actually see chicks develop, which is why they've been used as a system for a lot of studies historically. And what we did is we said, well, we know during embryogenesis that these endogenous neural crest cells come up from about here in the spinal cord. Here's the head, here's the developing cord. So we transplanted one of our little spheres. We had genetically tagged it to be green. So you can see this little green sphere of cells that comes from our mouse skin in this case. And we said, do they behave like the endogenous embryonic neural crest cells? And they did. They did everything right. They moved away from this spinal cord. They went out into sites that we know the endogenous cells go out into, and they formed the right kinds of nervous system cell types. So we were left then with the idea that what we had in our hands was a cell type that was used in the embryo to build all kinds of different tissues, and we had always assumed it just disappeared. But instead, we were then left with the hypothesis that it didn't disappear at all, but instead it was maintained in certain tissues, like the skin. And we could go into the skin and harness it, and then what we actually had in our hands was a cell that could do all these things in a tissue culture dish. So So the next question then was, well, why would you have cells like that in adult tissue? And as a way of trying to answer that, we asked where they might be. And the place that we found is, has led me to an area of research in my lab, which has led to some pretty funny pictures, which I'll show you in a minute, but which was completely unexpected. And what we found is what you're looking at here. This is actually an old histology textbook from my days when I taught cell biology and anatomy to medical students. And this is a hair follicle. And hair follicles have a very specific structure. Most of them are built of the same cells that build the outside layer of your skin, the epidermis. This isn't dermis at all. But right here at the bottom of these structures is a little patch of cells which come from the dermis and which no one has understood. They've been trying to understand them a long time. They have speculated there's some kind of precursor cell. They sit there. They don't proliferate very fast. No one's really been able to isolate them. But one important thing about them is they're the cells that are completely responsible for the hair cycle, hair follicle cycle, so the growth of new hairs up and down. So this is like morphogenesis over and over in adult tissue. And what we found is that this is the home for our cells, is this little place at the base of the hair follicle. And the reason that we discovered it was first just correlation. Again, we looked and said, where are these genes that we know our cells express, where are they expressed in the skin? And what we found, here's a picture of an actual hair follicle, instead of just a drawing out. Here's this little home, or niche, as we call it. And we found that our particular markers for our SCIPs were expressed in this particular place down at the base of these hair follicles. Here in blue is what the expression is. Moreover, people have known that these cells express certain markers themselves. So the converse was also true, that SCIPs express markers for germinal papilla cells. So now we had a two-way correlation. But the really definitive experiment came when Ian McKenzie in my lab did something he had never thought he'd be doing. He came to my lab to study neurobiology, which is to take whisker follicles from rodents, which are big. You can actually dissect them out, and that's what this is. This is a picture of a whole whisker follicle. You can actually go in, right here where this arrow is pointing, is where the dermal papilla for these whisker follicles is. You can actually go in and dissect that out, purify those cells, they're sitting right here, put them under our culture conditions and ask if we can make our SCIPs out of cells that are in that location. And the answer was that yes, we could indeed make these cells that floated as spheres and that then made different cell types. So now we had a bit of a paradox. We had a cell that came from an embryo that was used to build an embryo that was then resident in adult skin and was for some reason or other associated with hair follicles. So the question was, what does it do there? So again, we did I called the other kitchen sink experiment, I call this a sledgehammer experiment. We kind of just put it back into skin and said, what does it do? And in this case, what you're looking at is a section of rodent skin, and we transplanted in, again, these tagged cells, genetically tagged, that we've made SCIPs that are green. And you can see that this is the epidermal layer of the skin. They don't really go into the epidermis, but they go all over the place in the dermis. But the most interesting result was to us is that they seem to go back to the home that they came from. And right what I'm pointing to here is this little place at the base of a hair follicle. And I'll show you an easier to understand picture. And here it is again. This is a hair follicle this way. And here's this little thing at the base that comes from the germinal papilla. And it's completely comprised of these transplanted green SCIP cells. So these cells not.
You put those into an embryo again? Or you
no, this is adult skin now. What we do in this particular experiment, we do this, talk about embarrassing experiments, talk about wounding, I can talk about. The other thing that my postdoc does, he doesn't like to talk about much, is he defilates them. You know, like meat. Like, you know, you tear the hairs out. And then, it's mostly a male audience, they would know defilation. And that induces new hair follicle formation, actually, in a new hair growth cycle. And that's when you actually get these hairs that look like their whole, this control center is completely made from our transplanted cells.
And can you make hair grow in
the $1 million question. So can we make hair grow? And this is a long way from the brain and spinal cord, but at any rate, so
it's like a gold mine.
Yeah, that's right. That's
good. Why
yeah. We have asked that question, and the way we've asked it, this is really old-fashioned experiments. If you take like a little, it's called a C57 black mouse, the only thing that matters about it is it has pigment, so it grows black hairs. If you just take the skin from those mice at birth, and they don't have hair yet, right, and you just take both epidermal and dermal cells and mix them up into single cells, and then you inject them. This is a nude mouse. It looks like a little pig. It's just a nude mouse. It has a genetic defect that doesn't make hair. And you inject these cells in a little patch under its skin. Those, they have the capacity, because they have all the cell types there, to make some black hairs. But this is an induction system. So what we did is we mixed our tag skips, which were green, with these cells, all the right mixtures there, very old-fashioned experiment, and asked if we made hairs whose dermal component or control center was made from our transplanted skip cells. And what you get is you get all these little patches. You can actually see the little black hairs here. If you take that out, this is the kind of picture you get. These are all little black hairs that are all growing in a funny sort of mixture under there. And look now, if you look under the fluorescent microscope, the base of all of these, which looks like a little light bulb at the end of it or something, those are all our transplanted cells. So our transplanted cells have actually gone in and told the mouse cells that they were mixed with, the black mouse cells, to make hair. And an even more schematic diagram of that is this picture, which we just did. And not only did they tell them to make hair, they tell them to, in this experiment, the skips came from a rat, which have longer white hair than do mice. So they told the mouse epidermal cells to make rat hair. And you can see that, this patch here, this is all the little mouse hair here. This is the long rat hair. It's remarkable that you just put these cells in and somehow they have all the information, not only to dictate, say, make a hair, but to actually the characteristics of that hair. Because they don't actually, the hair itself is not made of our transplanted cells, remember. The only thing is this little control center at the base of them that comes from our transplanted cells. So the answer is, much to my surprise, that yes, they can make hair. And the experiment we've actually done now.
Okay.
But a lot of old men running around rapping. We've actually gone in now with this kind of an experiment, and we've harvested out these little green cells again. And we've asked, are they multipotent? Can they make hair of the system cell types? And the answer is yes. So this is really a remarkable thing where we kind of come around this. I never would have predicted a thing in the world that what we have in our hands is a cell that probably endogenously is important for things like hair follicle formation, wound healing the dermis, but that can make these other cell types because that's what it did in the embryo. So to come back to that what, where, and why, it's an embryonic stem cell that persists in the dermis, probably to participate in morphogenesis, in other words, development over and over, that also participates probably in wound healing, and that sits there in this little niche.
So, I mean, if these cells are present in wound healing, then how do you get these nude mice in the first place? I mean, do they not have the cells?
Do they not? Oh, the defect in the nude mice, the ones, the little, these ones,
yeah.
It's not in the dermal cells. People know from experiments they've done mixing and matching, the defect in those mice is in the epidermal cells, don't make hair. Do you see what I mean? So if
I see, so they're deeper in the...
Yeah, so if we go back to this picture, you need two things to make a hair, right? You need the inductive center down here, which is our skip cells, which are dermal, and you need all the things that comprise the hair, the structural components, if you will. The genetic defect in those nude mice is in this. So it doesn't matter how much inductive signal you have, if there's no machinery there to induce to make a hair. It doesn't
okay, work. So then why just putting the...
That's not the... So this experiment, we've mixed it with epidermal cells from a little black mouse, which is why the hairs are black. And then in this experiment, this is just an ordinary variety mouse, right? It's got its own white hair. It's just in this case, I to be frank, if you told me this experiment was going to work, I never would have believed you. This is bizarre because, first of all, the rat cells have gone in and they really like it in the mouse. This is a cross-species thing we're doing here, right? That usually doesn't happen. And secondly, that it would actually recruit the structural machinery of the mouse hairs and tell it to make a hair that was like a rat hair. I mean, who understands that? I have no clue.
So these aren't mouse hairs?
They're mouse hairs, yeah, the structural machinery of the hair itself is mouse. Because all we put in was the inductive cells. We never put in the structural cells, which are come from the epidermis.
Yeah, but I guess that contains the program.
It can, that's exactly the concept. These are the, that's the control center, right? You know, and
they're using mouse raw material to make rat hair.
Precisely. Yeah. That's precisely it. Or, I mean, it's still mouse hair. It's just, it's mouse hair with characteristics of a rat hair, like longer length and all those kinds of things. I mean, it's really, there is precedent for this in avians. Quails and chicks have different patterns of feathers. And you can actually, I don't know how they've been done, but people have taken the dermis cells from a quail and they've transplanted them into a chick. And now the chick makes feathers with the pattern of the quail. So what's remarkable about that experiment is it's not just that they're making feathers that are like quail feathers. Somehow the patterning information of spacing of the feathers is coming from dissociated single cells that you put in. Now, how that would work, how you can put patterning, three-dimensional information, or two-dimensional information in that case, through isolated little cells you dump in is a complete mystery. So I just wanted to end up on, can you use these kinds of cells therapeutically? Now we were convinced they were a real thing, that they weren't just some kind of weird thing we were seeing in a tissue culture dish. And what I'm going to tell you is that we think we can use them therapeutically. And the cell type that we focused on is a cell that makes this myelin insulation I told you about. Neural crest stem cells in the embryo make all of the nerves in your body outside here, outside your brain and your spinal cord. Okay, so the nerves that go to your, all your muscles and run the muscles. Those nerves also have insulation. That insulation is made by this cell called a Schwann cell. The name doesn't matter. What matters is that once we knew what we had in our hands, we went to development and we said, we know during development that these, and this is an informed experiment now, right? We know these cues tell these cells to make these myelin-producing cells. And we use those cues in a dish, made them, purified them, and were able to grow them in large numbers, these long bipolar cells. And we then put them in, back into the nerve. And we said, number one, do they survive? And number two, do they make this insulation? And the bottom line to both those questions is yes. What you're looking at here is what we've done is we've just injured a nerve in a rat in this case. Out here in your peripheral nervous system, those nerves will regenerate. So we put our cells in and we asked whether our cells made the insulation around the newly regenerating nerves. And this is the whole nerve you're looking at here. Again, we've used this green tag for our transplanted cells. And you can see that they've made a huge contribution to this nerve. This red is specific expression of one of the genes that turns on when they make this myelin. And we can actually go to the electron microscope, which is what you're looking at here, and we can use techniques so that we can recognize the cells that we transplanted. We recognize them with gold particles under the electron microscope. You can see these gold particles here. And what you're looking, this layered structure here, is myelin. This is the insulation. So our transplanted cells went in and did all of the right things and were functional in an animal. Well, why would we care about that? Since your peripheral nervous system repairs itself pretty well anyway. Well, the reason we care about it is for spinal cord injury. And in spinal cord injury, when you get, if you're a human and you do something like you're 18 and you dive into water, you don't know, they have a motorcycle accident and all the variety of things people do to themselves. What happens is that's not like a cutting of your spinal cord, it's a contusion, it's a hit. And what happens is you get this big cavity forming. And actually in most human beings, even though, you know, we talk about them being a spinal cord, you know, a victim at this level, it's like they cut it off. But in reality, not all the tissue is gone. Yeah, you've destroyed a lot of it, but you still have this whole area where you still have tissue. The problem, though, is that in that area that remains, that insulation has gone off the nerve cells that are still running through it. So one strategy for treating spinal cord injury has been, what if we could have a cell like the Schwann cells that would fill this injury site and produce myelin on the nerve cells that are still connected? Could we help these people? And the answer is, it looks like, at least at the beginning days, this is done in rats again, like maybe we can. These are two spinal cords that have come from animals, rats. And this is work, I should say, has been done with Wolfgang Tesla, my colleague at UBC. In his lab, he does the spinal cord injury experiments. He's with the Rick Hansen Center. You can see this big hole. This is this contusion injury I told you about. And here's this scarred tissue around it. If we transplant our Schwann cells that we've made from our skips, and again, they're fluorescently tagged, you can see that not only do they fill a very large part of this cavity, but they make a bridge across it. Moreover, I won't go into the molecular details of this, but these pictures I'm showing you here demonstrate that they are producing, they're associating with nerve cell axons, or the connections, and they're myelinating. Moreover, we actually get some functional locomotor recovery. And here I'm just showing you, it doesn't really matter the specifics of what the assay is here. We're monitoring whether these animals will spontaneously, unlike humans, spontaneously generate some locomotion, some walking activity, but it's never coordinated, it's not fine-tuned, it's not right. And what you see here is you can see that over time from their injury, they have gained some locomotion, but here you can see that the animals that were treated with these Schwann cells are in significantly increasing the amount of recovery they've got. So, I just wanted to summarize in the last few minutes by saying what I think are really, I mean, I've used this, this is our own work, but I think this is a very common sort of theme if you're listening to people who are working in the stem cell field. There's huge numbers of people working on the therapeutic side, of course, but there's a large number of people working on the basic biology side. And the questions that they're really interested in are things like I've discussed today. You know, I've talked about stem cells from the skin, from the brain. People are working very hard with their stem cells in the heart, a tissue we don't think can repair itself. Is it that, contrary to what we thought 10 years ago, maybe all adult tissues actually have stem cells in them? We just don't use them very well. And I think this is, now this is getting off into deep speculation, but are they a remnant, some of them, in some places from animals that can regenerate? If I took a goldfish, I can cut its spinal cord and it will completely regenerate it. If I take certain kinds of amphibians, I can cut off a limb and you'll completely regenerate the limb. And interestingly, the cells that regenerate the limb, many of them come from the dermis. So the issue is this simply we have these stem cells in all these tissues because in earlier organisms they were used, but we've lost the capacity. Some people would say, well, why would you want to lose the capacity? Well, there's two arguments for that. And again, this is all wild philosophy and speculation. The first is that the flip side of having cells that are so plastic and able to regenerate is that they also potentially can lead to cancer. And the argument is that we have been trying to suppress, by natural selection, cancers early on, in particular before childbearing age, very actively, and perhaps we've lost the ability to regenerate as a consequence. The second argument has to do with the nervous system. I told you that the nervous system has stem cells there that can make new nerve cells. Well, why wouldn't it be an advantage for us to always be making new nerve cells? Well, it probably is not an advantage, actually. We spend the first two decades of our life building a nervous system that functions appropriately for the kinds of things we're asked to do as human beings. Now, do you want all of a sudden to have a bunch of new cells coming in there all the time, making new connections that might not be part of that hardwired circuitry? I mean, you want some flexibility, but you don't want too much. So that's the argument for why in places like the brain, we might not want to have very good stem cells, and we might not want to have very many new nerve cells. And to go back to this issue of stem cell therapy, I told you about how we're trying to move ahead on one front with regards to cell transplantation. But like I said, I mean, it's maybe it's just a dream at this point, but if instead of having to transplant cells in, which let's face it, it's a pretty radical thing to have to do to a person, if you could instead convince the endogenous stem cells to repair a tissue, wouldn't that be better? And finally, I wanted to leave you with, even though I've talked about cell transplantation, that's mostly what you see in the papers, probably the biggest clinical payoffs will stem from stem cells will not be cell therapy. In the beginning, it will be things that are somewhat less tangible and not as sexy, but in the end might have much bigger payoffs. For example, when we study certain neurodegenerative conditions with genetic components. So think Parkinson's, Alzheimer's disease, a lot of things that peripheral neuropathies that you get out here. How do we study them? We don't, right? That's the bottom line. We either use animal models. Now we're getting imaging techniques, or you take autopsy material. It's an end game, right? This is a nervous system that's been destroyed by a disease. What if we had a way, for example, by using our cells for the skin, where we could go into genetically compromised patient populations, take a small biopsy, grow up their stem cells, and make nerve cells from them that we could study that were genetically compromised? Then, once we knew something about what was wrong with those cells, perhaps then we could use them as a tool to screen for small molecules that might partially eradicate the deficit they have. So I think, in a sense, stem cells can provide a whole, and humans in particular, a whole other way of doing research that we haven't really, in biomedical science, haven't really grasped yet, and are really only just starting to develop. And finally, I mentioned, I don't know those of you who were reading the Globe and Mail in the past 2 days might have seen something about this, but this has led to a whole new field, which is cancer stem cells. And cancer stem cells really, what the idea is there, that like an embryo, not every cell in cancer is really the parent cell, that most of the cells in a cancer have just differentiated, and actually they're not responsible for making the tumors, that there's a stem cell in there that's sort of the parent cell that makes the tumors, and that really what we should be doing is isolating those cells and figuring out how to kill them, rather than just trying to get the tumors smaller and smaller. And there's a scientist in Toronto named John Dick, who 10 years ago discovered the first cancer stem cell in a blood cancer. And the reason this was in the Globe and Mail is he's just discovered one of the, I think, the third or fourth example in the paper in Nature in colon cancer, which is one of the most widespread cancers. So I think, again, this is a case where just having the cells in hand will allow us to develop therapies that we couldn't develop otherwise.
So there's a question. Reciprocally, why is it that you say that stem cells can lead to cancer?
So your average cell, if your average cell took a genetic hit, because that's what happens as you get older, right? I mean, the easiest thing probably to think about is your skin, because that's what we think of being exposed to the outside world, to chemicals, or to sunlight, UV, whatever your particular carcinogen is. If one of these cells, takes a hit, it can have a bunch of genetic lesions, but most of the time, if it gets too bad, it'll just die. It'll write itself out of the equation. We've already heard the question of, are stem cells really immortal? The idea is they are. So it's almost impossible, or it's very difficult to kill stem cells. So now you have a situation where if you have a lot of stem cells, you have a cell that is going to take the same genetic hits from the environment that any other cell would take. But it's pretty hardy. It's pretty hard to kill. It's not going to die as a consequence of those hits. And even worse, it can proliferate indefinitely almost already. So the idea, and I think all the work on cancer stem cells is reinforcing this, the idea is that maybe many of the tumors we have already came from stem cells. People never used to think that way. They used to think that it was our, a liver tumor came out of, a liver cell going bad. But maybe instead most of them come from liver stem cells going bad. So that's why people sort of think maybe then it's a trade-off, right? You don't want too many. So anyway, I just wanted to end there. And anybody's interested in the question and the whole sort of ethical thing, we can discuss that. And just say that I didn't really talk, and I should have more, about the people in the lab who've done this, but I just wanted to emphasize that that really this has been a lot of work by a whole series of really talented postdocs and students in mine and other people's labs, my collaborators, as I said. The spinal cord injury stuff is being done in collaboration with Wolf and Tess Lab at UBC, and the chick experiments with Vic Rayfus. And to thank you for listening to something with a, as I said, a single equation in it. So thank you.
Thanks also for that last explanation.
So just the ideal thing to treat a person would be to take some of their own SKDs,
yes,
and use it someplace else,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that is the whole rationale.
So how far away do you think that is in practical terms?
Well,
10 years, 20 years, 5 years?
Well,
next
perhaps clinical trials sooner than I would have thought. The spinal cord injury thing has gone way better than I would have. I mean, I tend to be skeptical, like watch scientists, right? And always thinking everything's way far off.
And I'm also not a clinician, so I'm even more, you know, skeptical about clinical things. We would, it's possible if, as we pursue this more, that the skips might go into clinical trials for spinal cord injury within, say, 5 years, the very early stages. Now, whether that will actually treat them or not is a whole different issue, right? But I think that's kind of the timeline that my clinical colleagues are hoping for. For other disease, I mean, actually for more proximal things, if you were talking about wound healing in the skin, cartilage replacement in the knee, those could even be sooner, actually. There are people, companies, one called Osiris in the States, who is going into clinical trials with another kind of stem cell that can only make those mesodermal cell types. It's an adult stem cell from humans. They're not doing it autologously, like you said, from the people's own skin, but from other people. And they're in clinical trials with that already for cartilage replacement.
Why not do it from their own skin? Wouldn't that happen?
Oh, because in that case, they haven't figured out how to expand the cells enough. That's one of the things I mentioned about many of the adult stem cells. Skips are different, and actually the brain stem cells are different too. They grow very well. Blood stem cells proliferate virtually not at all. So if I were to take yours, it would just be impossible. From the skin I could, but many of the ones that they're talking about, their clinical trials for this other cell type, they can't grow enough from an individual.
But the simplest thing that comes to mind with these skin cells is whether you could grow another skin. There's lots of people who get burned. Have people try to do that, to grow a piece of skin?
We're starting to try and do that now. And we're collaborating with a group at Laval who has made... There's lots of groups that make the epidermal layers, right? That's a technology that's out there and that people use for burn victims now. The problem has been what you're alluding to. The dermis layer hasn't been there. And so it just doesn't hold. It doesn't stay. Frequently what it does is gives you a covering for long enough that your own skin cells can then hopefully come in and repair it. But I would love to do that, you know? You know one of the problems, I'll tell you right now, And this isn't just in the Canadian Biomedical Consortium, but in the States as well, is there's a money for the basic research. There's even money to get into kind of translational type things. You know, like my colleagues at UPC are interested in trying to take a spinal cord injury, I'll provide the human cells to the next level, you know, to go to clinical trials. There is no money, though, for kind of large-scale clinical trials, which are very expensive. And or even if you develop the therapies, in our system in Canada, who's going to pay the money for it? You know, our medical system is getting more and more expensive all the time. And there's even cancer drugs, as you see in the papers a lot, right, that we know are efficacious. And that our medical system isn't paying for people to get those drugs. These kinds of therapies are very expensive. And unfortunately, it's almost like we're going to be headed for as we develop fancier and fancier therapies, if you will, that are more and more personalized, so better in a sense, they're also more and more expensive. So it's very difficult. We've been talking about that very experiment for ages, but where do I get I need the clinical colleagues and the money to then try to take it to the next step of building these things in addition, using them. So I'm not really complaining. It's one of the logistical roadblocks in the system, I think.
Are animals like amphibians
more
susceptible to cancer? Is it
not? They don't live as long. Right? No. I mean, it's no joke. I mean, I've had this. This is a, you know, and whenever you work in areas where you don't know much, there's a lot of this kind of discussion that goes on. They don't live very long, and frogs can get certain types of cancers. I know frogs can. Newts and things don't live, maybe some of them live as long, but they certainly don't live as long as we do. I think one of the problems with cancers. The older an organism, as an organism, the longer its lifespan, the more cancer there is for mammals anyway.
Is it possible to design an experiment that artificially make the animal older than it should be?
Well, it seems someone raised the issue of Dolly, the clone sheep, right? An area that really intense interest right now is what makes a cell know how old it is, right? I mean, and what makes an organism know how old it is. And one of the, well, actually, it's not an idea, there's good evidence for it, is at the end of your chromosomes, you have these things called telomeres. You know, it's telo for end of the chromosome. And telomeres are
a fixed length. And the idea is that over time, they get shortened, and that's part of the mechanism that tells your cells how old they are. So the shortening process, the balancing between, you know, lengthening a bit and shortening is going to be different in different species. So the problem is when you make a cloned animal like Dolly, you're taking a cell that has already shortened its telomeres, and you're putting it back in, and you're making a new organism, like a, it's like a baby in every other way, but its telomeres are shorter. So Dolly actually was older in its cell age than it was in its organism age, and they don't live as long. And the other issue with the whole cloning thing that people don't talk about a lot, and they should actually, is that part of our makeup as human beings has to do with epigenetics, that is modifications that aren't just coded by this, your DNA sequence, right? And also by things to do with our mitochondrial DNA, which comes from our mother. And there's something called paternal imprinting, which you have to go through the normal process of development to get the correct maternal imprint. And maternal imprinting has a lot to do with both growth, how much you grow, and actually with neurological things. So if you take a cloned cell and you make an embryo out of it, that maternal imprinting doesn't happen properly. And so one of the things that you see with cloned animals, even cloned mice, is all kinds of aberrant growth patterns, just giant mice instead of little mice of the right size. I mean, it's really bizarre. And that happened, I think, with Dolly as well, some of those litter mates. I think they were the wrong size. And so when people talk about human cloning, that's why, I mean, even if you didn't have any ethical issues with that, most of us do have ethical issues with that, but even if you didn't, there are scientific reasons why we just, you know, the crazy people who are trying to do it should just, I mean, it should, I personally think it should be illegal. I mean, that's just, it's like a recipe for creating, you know, people with defects. So it's really, so yeah, the experiments have been done. I don't know how to end in there, but.
Suppose you succeed, or someone succeeds in the clinical use of stem cells for something or other. How do we know that this would cause cancer in these patients, you know, down the road? If you have a bad knee and got a good knee, but in 5 years you're bound to have a bowel cancer, that's not good.
Yeah.
And many people prefer to leave.
Oh, well, absolutely.
You gain 5 years.
Yeah.
It's a good thing.
You can't ever.
There's been no evidence with yet, but remember, most of the work has been done in short-lived rodents, right? I mean, this is one of the issues of all this work, right? There's no evidence as of yet that adult stem cells have ever led to any kind of tumor. But the dirty secret that the embryonic stem cells people don't talk about very often, and now it's being published more and more, is that if you get one undifferentiated embryonic stem cell, that is sufficient to cause a tumor. So there was just a report just came out in a journal, Nature Medicine, and they were trying to work with embryonic stem cells on Parkinson's disease. So the kind of neurons or nerve cells that are missing in Parkinson's disease make a particular neurotransmitter, dopamine. So they've taken these human ES cells and they went to all these great lengths to make this right kind of nerve cell. And they had this rodent model, and they put it in, and it was miraculous. It really cured the, you know, the deviant behavior that these poor animals had. I mean, they just spin in circles under a certain cue. But every one of them got a tumor in their heads. Now that's embryonic stem cells, and you know, a lot of people, to be frank, don't believe or are skeptical that embryonic stem cells will make it to the clinic for that reason. Personally, that's one of the reasons we're not, I mean, it's, ethics is one reason, but I mean, my personal feeling is, for me, one of the bigger reasons is, I think they're amazing tools to study development and to do some amazing biology and maybe the kinds of screening things we talked about, but for cell transplantation, I could never live with it if, you know, I couldn't purify those cells 100% and just one undifferentiated cell have to escape my protocol and something about a tumor from it. But for adult stem cells, there's no evidence for that as of yet. So although you can argue, well, they haven't lived long enough or whatever, you know, I think that, you know, it really depends on the severity of the disease. So.
Okay, well, maybe that's a good place to close. Thanks very much, Andrew.